This is tape two with Dennis Surrett and interviewed by Mike Smith at the Ruther Library on December 5th, 2001. When we ended the first tape, Dennis, we just got you into your job with the phone company and your first experiences with CWA, Communication Workers of America. I wondered if you could take us through through your career, your work life, and your union life as it goes through this period.
Well, it was really an exciting experience to get a job with the New York Telephone Company because it was considered one of the best career opportunities for anybody, regardless of whether they were working class or whether they were privileged,
How did you get the job? Did you know someone or just lucked out?
I lucked out. That's the only way I can explain it. I just finished with the job I was fired at Mason Hill at Fullerville Laboratories. I had put in an application for the New York Telephone Company, well before that, and never got a call. And I just was going back to check on it, and in that process, they said, yeah, we have you on file, and, you got to take a test, And I went down, took a test, passed the test, I'm good at tests. And it was at a time when, I guess, 1963, all that was going on, in the early stages of 63 especially, that the civil rights movement was in full bloom, and I think they were under a little bit of pressure to start hiring blacks, in a way, because when I got on the job, it turned out I was just about the only black there. This was a department of at least, on that floor, must have about 70, 80 personnel, and there were about two of us. And so that's how I started. It was down at 4 Albany Street in Lower Manhattan. So when I started, I considered it a great job. I loved drafting, and this is someplace I was glad to be. I had a budding family. I was really starting to think of this as a great time, my wife and I really economically started thinking futuristically. I was just fresh out of the service, so I looked at it with great value. So when I started there, I obviously took note of the fact, given my experiences with the whole racial situation, that I was about the only black in there. And the other black that was there wasn't talking to me. For some reason or another, he felt that it was a conspiracy. Two blacks were talking to each other or something. And that's what I got out of it, future conversations. At the time, I was going back and forth in the home. I was living out in Queens, listening to many speakers and staying involved in a lot of the struggle. So I still had a high state of consciousness then. And I was introduced to the union. His name was O'Neill. He was from Ireland. He was born in Ireland. As many of those who were working there were literally coming off the boat without tests and being hired by the telephone company. Not only Irish, but Italians as well. And I took note of that after a while. And so over a period of time, I would see many African-Americans coming in to apply for a job, and resumes and all kinds of stuff. And they would have to be interviewed by Bob Bowen. He was the supervisor at that time. Gregor was my supervisor. His superior was Bob Bowen. So they would have to send him up there as a final, do you want him or don't you want him, kind of thing. And I've seen this over a period of months, that they would be there on a Friday, and there would be a white guy on Monday that would be hired, a guy that never came through the office. And when these guys came in, I would talk to them and say, hey, how'd you guys get in here? So I went down and, I applied for a job. And I said, and you got by the test? I didn't have to take a test. I said, well, what about your portfolio? He said, I ain't got no portfolio. I'm like, okay. I said, well, that's kind of great for you, man, but I said, there's some strange things happening around here. So that's when I started, when I see the black guys come up, I would follow them out when they had finished their interview to the elevators. Give me your phone number, and I'll get back to you to see who's hired you. And we'll see if we'll do some comparisons. with their qualifications, see whether there's discrimination going on here. And they would do that, you know, not qualified. Most of the guys were applying to other places, but none of them really pursued, you know, fighting the telephone company, which was considered a very rich and powerful company at the time. So, but now I had a frame of mind in which I start talking with the white workers. I say, is this fair? I say, you guys didn't even take a test. And look what happened here, you know. And I went to my immediate supervisor, which was McGregor. And he was an old guy, white hair, and, you know, grandfatherly type of guy, you know, warm and all. And when I broached the subject with him, his whole attitude and everything changed, you know. And he said, Dennis, he says, you have a good job here. He says, and you don't want to raise those kinds of questions, because if you do, he says, you're going to be a troublemaker. And the troublemaker, he says, it could cost you your job. I said, Joe, are you threatening me? He says, no. I said, well, I said, it's just unfair. You know, I think it's unfair. And many of my other fellow workers also said, Dennis, get off of that, you know. So I knew then, you know, because I went to the union. They were the first ones to approach me, the CWA. I said, what can the union do? And he says, the union can't touch anything to do with employment. I says, well, this is like insane. You know, why is there a line here? You know, when there's a major wrong happening. I said, this is why my father couldn't get a damn job. You know, and somebody else's, your father could. You know, and I said, you didn't have to take a test. They took a test, you know. So he said, well, I have nothing to do with that. I just came for a job. I said, okay, I'm not blaming you guys, but it's wrong, you know. So I went up, I asked to speak to the next boss, which was Bob Bowen. My immediate supervisor went through the same thing, and he turned crimson red, and he was really pissed off, you know. So I knew I was up the creek in that place after that, you know. I got along with most of the guys, but then some of them started steering away from me. And at the time, we were being raided by the Teamsters, you know, and they took us into these on company time, these rooms, where we would all look at these movies on the Teamsters of Hoffa, you know, blowing up things and light. Unions were bad and all of this sort of stuff, you know, and I was going like, and that was my introduction. I didn't know, you know, and I was going like, it just doesn't seem right, you know, but CWA, you know, they sort of preferred CWA over the Teamsters at the time. So I was beginning to get acquainted with labor through those particular points in my early portions of my career in 1963. And O'Neill, who was a guy I really liked, an Irish guy from the other side with a great sense of humor, you know, obviously was not going to rock the boat, even was anybody else in there. And I had already rocked the boat, and I knew I was in for rough goings, you know, for a while in there. And it was really interesting. I drew up plans for the World Trade Center, you know, for the telephone company, you know, with the engineer. I did the drafting courses of it, you know, for all the telephone company in the World Trade Center, you know, as well as New York Hilton and a few other, the Pan Am building and these places in New York City at the time, you know. That doesn't mean anything, but sort of like in the light of 9/11, you know, I was looking at that and going like, wow, you know, I'm the guy that drew up the plans for the engineer for the plans of that. But anyway, in the drafting department, you know, there were no black engineers down. They were on another floor. And then there was one that popped up after a year and a half while I was there. And we used to talk all the time. They were considered manager, really. But we would talk, and, you know, and he was saying this is horrible, you know, the hard time that he was having, you know, and he quit, and he's not quitting. And these are the kind of conversations that happen. In the meantime, we've had union actions in which I found out for the first time what a strike was, you know, the picket line, and how the force of the union was operating against the company. And that's when I became convinced, is that any time you have an organization like this that can counter somebody as big as a telephone, there's nobody around that can stand up to these guys, but the union can, you know. So I was convinced at that point that labor was the answer, not only for workers, but it was the answers for black people and everybody that wanted to fight these guys that were in charge. You know, so I really took to labor big time at that time. And when I went to union meetings, they were all white. And, you know, all the leadership was white. you know, and I reckoned after a while, it was a case of, you know, the telephone company being discriminatory all those years, and that the union was going to actually reflect the hiring practices of the company. And that's what had happened. So, you know, you couldn't blame the union totally for what it looked like. But I began to try to understand why the union had, seeing that this was unfair, and all the attention to the civil rights situation, why they hadn't taken a principled stand on this. You know, why didn't they say there's something wrong here? There are no blacks, no Latinos, there's no women in these jobs, you know, and stand up for something. And I thought they were complicit. It was conspiratory that the union, you know, as long as they were getting their due, decided to look the other way. And soon after, I moved out of the drafting department into what they call the frame. The frame was a part of the electrical aspects of, you know, the telephone company, the telephone service. It would be more physical jobs, one of the lower echelon jobs in which you'd actually run wires in buildings that were sometime a block long, you know, and connected with equipment on one side and connected with a cable on the other side, and you would conspire to talk with testers who would be talking to craftsmen out in the field to repair telephones and things like that. And so the frame was sort of like an assembly line type of job, and that was about in 1966-67. And it was during that time, you know, that the Civil Rights Act and all of these things started passing and started to impact, you know, the telephone company. And there were a few blacks that were on the frame. Matter of fact, they started, by that time, they had quite a few blacks there. You know, it was about 30-40%. They still had a lot of Irish guys there. And I remember the one incident, and it was really interesting. I replaced this guy when I came in drafting, called Bob McCracken, an Irish guy. And everybody would talk about him being such a great steward and stuff like that. And then when I went into 37th Street, you know, this is telephone book, I ran into Bob McCracken, and it was so weird, we took a liking to each other, you know, and the odd piece was, he was born on the same day, in the same year that I was, you know, so we were black and white, and at that time in television, you had the I Spy thing, you know, that was going on, so they would call us the I Spy crew, because at that time, most of the building was not organized into the union. And he said, well, look, you know, you might be a steward too. And I mean, even though I was a steward in drafting, you know, but couldn't get much action, I lost my stewardship. And then when you move, and then you had to be a steward again, and there weren't that many members, so I became a steward in there, you know. And that started my reign of union activism.
The second steward position.
Second steward position that I had. And McCracken was also a steward. We were both angry, and we had a chief steward that wasn't doing anything about the oppressive conditions that were taking place on the frame, you know. So we started organizing people, signing people up, you know, at that time. But before that time, I had gone to union meetings that were all white, you know, looking for other blacks that may be around and may feel the same way. And I, all the time, walking past this guy in crack and never meeting him, you know. And then now that I was at this place, you know, he was a very active guy and very astute on the labor piece. And we kind of learned with each other grievances and organizing and pulling people in. By that time, 67, larger numbers of blacks were coming into the company in mass. And by that time, Bob had become the chief steward, you know, and I had become like really the major steward in the building. And the building housed at least 2,000 people, and everybody knew us, and we were taking on situations in a militant way that hadn't been taken on before. I remember one case, a guy named Taylor, an Irish guy, and he had played soccer and all these games with bats and all that sort of stuff, and his face looked like it. He had he had stitches where he had everything going. And he had a family of about 8 or 9 kids. And, you know, but he was always good for a laugh back and forth. We'd always be joking with each other, you know. And I had become, while organizing the frame, I had got a lot of confidence in me, and I've become like the guy, the go-to guy, you know. The militant action against the managers, they know they had to go to me to solve problems. And John Calamari, one of the guys that were foreman there, had came across Taylor doing something he was working on. He must have done something, maybe a mistake or something like that. And he came and started screaming at Taylor as though he was a kid. I mean, really screaming at him. And Taylor was on the floor, like in a flinching position, you know. And that picture will never go away in my mind, because I thought about Taylor and his wife. I thought about his kids. But they were all standing here watching this man in the house, you know, in this position. So I went up to Calamari and I told him, I said, back off. I said, don't you ever talk like an adult and you remember like that again, you know. So Taylor said, stay out of this event. I said, I'm not staying out of this shit. So we went back and forth, and then Calamari turned his attention to me. He said, let's go out in the hallway and talk, you know. And we went out to the hallway, and we had some long ones. If you ever walk up on me, if you ever yell at me, I said, we're going to have to deal with this like men. You know, and we went through that piece, and then I thought he was going to suspend me or fire me or something like that, but he didn't. You know, he went back inside. So it was on that. I had about half the frame organized, but that incident organized the rest of the half of the frame, and that was about 100-some people.
They were totally unorganized at that point, or they were saying they were jabbers but complained over Jones.
We had a certain portion of them organized. You know, and there was you have leadership, the people who said, I'm not going to the union, and there's a whole group of people that listen to them, you know.
Right.
And so sometimes you gotta win over that person, and like the whole rest of them, Taylor was one of those people. And after that incident, they all came up, signed me up. And that was the real start of a super struggle in there, because from there, you know, with the blacks coming in, and each time a new member came in, we would talk about the bad, the good, the ugly, try to help them train it. The company started pulling together a new plan, absence control type plans. You know, prior to this, you know, we used to go out on Thursdays, Fridays, guys would get drunk, sometimes they wouldn't come back, you know, the next day, they would never be reprimanded, they wouldn't have any trouble. But now that more blacks are coming, instituted what they call the absence control plan, absence and tardiness. And they had no tolerance for people of color, black and Latinos, and they would be firing like that. So, you know, people would come in and tell them, look, whatever you do, you've got to be on time and you can't be absent, you know, and all. Because we'll help you get through the work and understanding the work so you can do it. But I can't control that, you know, so. It was those kind of things. Then they started another plan, you know, that seemed to, in terms of the work, you don't do enough work. And so I began to see that no matter what we tried to do to satisfy some of the standards that the company had started putting in front of us, that it was never going to be enough. But they were really going after us big time, and that we had to confront it one way or the other. So the company at that time used to have a habit of going around and working. We had a contract working. By this time, we had started having enough grievances. I had become quite experienced at grievances, note-taking, and labor law, and with Bob. We would always pick the toughest manager in the building to fight, because we would always learn from him. This guy would kick our ass at times. But we remember the first time when this guy caught us flat-footed and we walked out of there and looked at each other and said, I didn't know that. You know, and that happened a few times, and so he said, this is the guy we got to fight. Because this guy knows his shit. The more we fight this guy, the more we're going to learn until we start kicking his ass. And we're going to be good at that. And we started doing that until we actually started. He was afraid to see us coming. You know, and that's when we started, you know, really doing major organizing. I used to go to membership meetings, and by this time, the larger numbers of blacks and Latinos that had come in, and we started demanding that there be more representation of blacks and Latinos in the jobs in certain areas. Like, the next job up was installers and repairmen. There were no blacks there. And then it was switchmen. There were no blacks there, and there were no black foremen. So we said, this is bullshit. This was in 1967, you know, 68. So we said, we got to break the color line. The civil rights movement is happening. You know, all these laws have passed. Go on the job. And everybody thinks it's all over. And we got to fight in here. I mean, this is where the struggle, all the people that got jobs now are being fired from jobs and they're not getting treated fairly. So our war was to get equality in the telephone company, no matter what the cost, no matter what it took. That was the way I thought at the time. And during that process of time, we tried to, I said, we can't do it alone. We got to push the union to do it. You know, I was totally convinced that with the resources of the union, the fact that we were paying our dues in the union, this was the instrument that we should use to fight, you know, the instrument that we couldn't beat by on ourselves. So we go to the union meetings and start raising these questions and ask them to get involved in terms of fighting these things. And it was then that the union thought we were just being troublemakers and activists and all, and started. We used to have fights, fist fights, literal fist fights in union meetings. Every time they would try and call us out of order, you know, and a lot of times the sergeant involved was drunk, you know, and they'd go pushing on you. And the union would break up with us, fighting, fist fights. In a damn meeting, and that's how the meetings would break. Then they started organizing with clubs when we would go to the meetings. Then they moved the meetings out of the traditional place and then warned us that if we came into these meetings, you know, that we wouldn't even get through the door. So we had to organize. They moved the meetings from, in 67, they moved it from Manhattan into Brooklyn. And that was a huge Italian area at the time, and Irish, and they said, if you come to this meeting, you know, you're not leaving. That was the line. And we organized car caravans, and we figured out ways in which, you know, we went through the area earlier to find phone booths, but they didn't have cell phones at that time, key phones, booths, and their phone numbers, you know. And we came ready. We came ready with anything we had to be ready with. And I say that, don't exclude anything, because we took them serious. And we had some, you know, folks that were with us, that women that carried stuff. We kept a lot of folks within a couple blocks if we had trouble, you know, how to come in. I mean, this is our own union, you know, and we had to fight the damn company, you know, to break lines, you know. But I said, at that time, along with many of us, you know, that this was by Gene Cooper, Guy at Davis, these are some of the guys I can recall that really stood up at that time, and Joe Roldan, these are some of the names of some of the more powerful people that I you know, that used to get fired along with me at times, you know. And we came around, and that meeting, long story short, yes, that meeting ended up in fisticuffs, ended up being bloody, and, you know, and they decided that no way they were going to stop us. We decided that when we got out of there, they got the worst part of this fight. And I mean, it was like shooting crazy stuff out of this. But prior to this, you know, in Manhattan Center, before this meeting, there was another confrontation in which they did come with guns and axes and things like that. And they'd come with a plan to rope us off, you know, and things like that, you know, at a later time. No, that wasn't prior to me. That was a 1 year later. So it was out of that meeting that we got a degree of respect. And we came to the next meeting in which we brought whites, blacks, everybody that would support our cause. And I remember his Father Carey that was going to be speaking that day. When everybody stood for the Pledge of Allegiance or something, he didn't play. None of us that came together stood up. So they knew there was trouble. And we had taken like the first 14 rows, you know. And some of our white friends came in and said, well, I want to sit in there too because I'm with you, you know. And that was a piece that we did. And they looked down at us, and the president at the time was McCabe. He later became a state mediator, Jim McCabe. And he looked down and he saw that, you know, we weren't standing for the Pledge of Allegiance because we always did that before a meeting. And he knew that we came, you know, to get some justice out of that meeting. And when everything had cleared, of course, whatever Father Carey came here to speak about, he was was speaking about something else. You know, and by that time we had begun to learn parliamentary procedure. We weren't intimidated anymore by it. We were changed going up business, and that was a ruckus all by itself, you know. But it was out of meetings like that, and those kinds of struggles initially in labor, you know, that we started getting them to move, and then which forced us to start organizing internally. That demonstration in 1968, in 1969, where we staged demonstrations, wildcat demonstrations, both against the Union. By that time, I had become a chief student, the first black chief student in 1101 in history, you know, and I had commanded an entire area that had like 4,000 or 5,000 workers in this huge local. And what was so great about it was it was black and white that would move. It wasn't just a black thing anymore, you know. So they kept wanting to label that, you know, to divide us. And what happened was more whites were saying that this is wrong. They were standing up with us. And I remember two demonstrations in particular, one at the 56th Street Central office, in which we had stayed up the whole night before writing up signs and saying that we were going to stage a 24-hour boycott of the job, and we were going to set up picket lines. That's the pictures you saw there. And at that, we had organization, and that's when I was the Minister of Information, and Cooper was the chairman of that particular group, and we were all doing the same kind of work on the different buildings, you know. So I was still the highest ranking guy around there in terms of the union. And they came down, the company said, threatened to fire us, you know. We had our flyers with the demands on it, what exactly what was happening, that we were going to give in on this stuff. You know, we had five classic demands, you know. And that was upgrades, and that was do away with these plans that were trying to do away with us, you know, and other, you know, other kinds of fair treatment type of pieces. And then they thought it was going on for another day, and just as magical, we were all back on the job again, you know. So now they were like, the union was gone, you know, what's going on with you guys? And, you know, now we're embarrassing the union because the union couldn't come and talk to us either. So they've been fighting us all this time, you know. Now they're figuring out, hey, we got to communicate with these guys, you know. And we told them what our demands were. We gave them our demands, and you know, they found that we was off. You know, they said they used the card like, you know, these guys can fire you. You know, it's only us who saved your job. They said, well, what about the demands? You know, well, you know, they can't satisfy this. We had to use the grievance process. 2 weeks later, we did it at a different central office. Outside, did the same thing. Now they knew it was conspiratory. Oh man, what's going to happen now? It's going to happen all over the damn company, you know. And this time you had the heads of the labor relations department of the company, you know, came down, the union came down. Let's talk about this thing, you know. We had organized the Amsterdam News to come down to and reporters. We were calling all the different news media and all of that sort of stuff. And we were all blacks that were out there, you know, but we were giving out our flyers. And then some of the whites came out, and because they had read the flyers, and the demands and said, what is, they would ask questions about different things, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. And by noontime of that day, we had the entire building out. And it was sort of like, guys, you know. That was a brilliant moment for us, because at that time, you know, they told us that, you know, as long as we got the story out, question of fairness, not just black and white. We can have people who can sympathize with our cause and our struggle and wanting to have justice as well. And this is when the company quietly started upgrading certain people, and all of a sudden started opening up certain kinds of things, you know, and this is when the union started beating their chest and saying, see what we did for you, we said we did it right. Yeah, we said great, doing a great job. But we also figured we had to have some sort of organization and caucus, because we knew without this breaking the rules that we couldn't gain the things that we had gotten. And that, you know, from our experiences inside, that whatever gain we made, that we would have to hold on to that gain with some kind of organization. And we organized a group called the Brothers and Sisters for Equality. That was our first caucus inside CWA. And we also decided, because there were so many other areas to go, break down, and all these demonstrations we had done, we were getting, the company was very slow. We had gotten it, but in other areas they hadn't gotten it. We found out while we were organizing our caucus that the operators who were part of the company had worse problems than we had. We had gone to the Young Lords. They had a place in 125th Street. They occupied one of the Y's. They gave some space to one of our Latin brothers, Joe Van, and we had the Panthers that was with us during that period of time. We had the Amsterdam News writing articles about our fight, you know, Florence Rice, who's the advocate that was standing with us, you know. So we had Harlem with us during those particular struggles. You know, we had, and as a chief steward, I had a tremendous amount of experience about job actions, because we had, I had stayed in walkouts and developed a very good steward body, and we wouldn't take no crap from nobody, you know. But the company felt that, well, we can divide him from his people, but they found out instead that people came along because of the cost. So that, those were very, very powerful times for me in terms of understanding, you know. Also, you know, with my left tendencies, I was looking at the global picture on one side, and I was really more advanced than a lot of the workers that was there. You know, I certainly was dealing with things in Harlem. You know, was up front, you know, with many of the nationalist struggles that were going on in Harlem at the time. I had lots of friends, you know. I had, you know, I was a follower of Malcolm X when he was alive, you know. I never joined his organization. My brother Gerard did. Part of the groups that, you know, was pissed off the Farrakhan, and because I remember those stories and quotes at the time it was happening, Malcolm must die, and with that mosque burned down, I can say that I was somewhere close by, seeing that whole situation after Malcolm was killed. So I had heart at that time, and my heart was in the cause of the struggle, and there were many Blacks, even at that time, you know, before Malcolm had was killed, they were afraid of Malcolm. They were afraid to talk about him on the job. And all, you know, that abruptly changed. And for some reason, after Malcolm was killed, people would talk about Malcolm, and all of a sudden, he was very acceptable and palatable on the job, you know. So it was in that framework that we put together, you know, some of the demonstrations. But I have to give you this piece, because it's called the Mother's Day Demonstration, something that a lot of people haven't written about, but there's enough information about that is probably one of the heaviest stage demonstrations out of New York ever for minorities. When we were organizing the telephone workers inside CWA, you know, to get a larger caucus to persuade CWA to get more involved with the African-American struggle. Operators from another union, a company union, the Telephone Traffic Union, that was the name of it, was headed up by May Kleisch at that time, who we found out later was not only the person of that, but she was also a management person for the company. And, you know, it was all white leadership, and it was, and the operators were at that time almost all black, you know, black and Latino. And they had horrendous hours. And they would come to these meetings, these organizing sessions we would have at the YWCA, 925th Street. And we started hearing their stories, and their stories sounded worse than our stories. We said, well, damn, you know, here we are organizing for ourselves, but you guys, you don't have a union, you got nothing. So we turned the meetings over to them. We said, well, look, we'll help you to develop, you know, your piece. And maybe later you can come into CWA. So we're not in great standing with some of the leadership, but, you know, that would be a great thing. They represent 37,000 workers in New York State at that time. So they started coming in. We started organizing them and developing leadership, you know, all over the city with them. And we were trying to figure out, and they were, what we could do to continually help them to get organized, but they were all black and they were suffering these extreme cases. Well, it came a day, May 10th or 11th, 1970, where we call it Mother's Day demonstration walkout, where Rest Electric was due to walk out on that Monday, and they contract with West Electric called CWA. And we told them, this would be a great time for you guys to respect their picket lines. And at the same time, we'll have demands that we can put on the company, whether your union likes it or not, that are more in tune with the demands that you have. So we made up flyers on it, and we planned it out all over the city in terms of when West Electric worked out. Well, they got wind of it. It's impossible to keep that kind of information in. And West Electric called off their strike. So everybody's poised to go. And I said, don't worry about us. We'll go out, and with the picket line standing up, we won't come back in. That's all there is to it. And we'll be out with you, and we'll help you stage this piece, you know. So they call it off, you know, about 10 o'clock that day, and we're going, oh, hell, you know, this means nothing is going to happen, you know. So we, myself, Gene Cooper, Joe Rodan, Eddie Davis, this guy, Guy Cook, Edna Floyd, these are different people that I can recall played a big part of that. We start talking, calling back and forth and say, okay, what do we do? You know, do we go anyway or what? So we say, go anyway. We got everything set up, you know. This shit is on. You know, we might as well go and do it. So we said noontime. We passed the word around, and operators talked to each other like that. In a period of about 15 minutes, it was called all around the city and into the Bronx and in Brooklyn that at noontime, we're out of here. Then something went down where somebody, one of the operators, got antsy, and they were sent to home. Rory got back to us and said, we're going in the next half an hour. So we sent it around, and we went out first, and they said, when we go out, we'll call the next central office, and you'll know we're out, you know. So we went on the floor, and the signal was that we walked on the floor and said, okay, it's time. And the operators started jumping up, tearing down their headsets, you know, and it was sort of cool, and everybody grabbed their coats and left. And we started setting up picket lines, and then we call over, we drive over, we set up a picket line, because we had stuff ready to go anyway. And then across town, they were already out there. And before you know it, I mean, it was an incredible experience. They were out all over the city. And little did we know, it was spreading to points. After 2 days, you know, we set up chants and picket lines, and we had demands and things like that. We approached CWA and said, all these operators are out here. And, oh yeah, they called us and said, Surrette. I said, once y'all set up your picket line and we go out for lunch, we're not coming back past your picket line. So that'll give us our excuse to stay out there with you. And we can be all in a legal frame, you know. So that's what we did. We all stayed out with the operators. And we were the only CWA people that stayed out at that point. And we went to the union and said, these people ought to be organized. They ought to be a part of CWA. They have a just cause, and we laid it out for them. It's like, get your ass back in there. If you don't get your ass back in there, and all these companies got fired, and it's not a damn thing that we can do. So we said, we're standing out with these because this is what union's all about, you know, and we should be out there supporting them, you know. They said, well, we can't guarantee your safety. That's where we're coming from. So we were out there a week, you know, and we were getting calls from places like Philadelphia. Philadelphia went out. I don't know. We didn't even know they went out. You know, we heard rumors of Jersey, and spaces were going out, you know. And I learned from a company official. His name was Olson. When I became a union officer, this was before I became a union officer, in the elevator, he says, you know, that strike went all the way down to Washington. Never knew that, you know, how far it went. And he put a big dollar cost to it, too, you know, because most of the people there were not. And CWA, some of the operators in Jersey and Washington were organized by CWA. This group was not organized by CWA, but they all seemed a sisterhood kind of thing, and it was a spontaneous piece. But we lasted out there for 2 weeks. During that 2 weeks period of time, we all got letters from the company saying, you know, if you're not in by this time, you know, you're fired. And then letters, you know, register letters. we wouldn't sign for any of them. You know, they said you're fired. You know, and so we told we had gotten District 65 of distributed workers of DW, maybe, Cleve and all those people. And this is before I actually met Cleve, you know, the CBTU, come in and organize, because CWA wasn't going to organize. They needed another union. And we said, once we got that set up, we said, well, we got to go back in. We don't know how to do this. So we said, well, we'll go to the local, and we'll tell them, you know, you guys, because now they were taking leadership. And they said, well, we'll go to the local, and we'll tell them. So they advertised to all the buildings that the telephone operators were going to march on the local in support of the fired workers. We all fired workers, you know, 7 or 8 of us. And, you know, so it ended up being about 50 or 60 operators that went to the local. But when we turned the corner of the block, it was like, must have been close to like 300-400 construction workers. You know, they were construction workers. And we thought somebody was ready to jump off the building or something, you know, with all these people out here. What the company said, what the union did, was call and say that there was a siege on the local. And that, you know, and told the company they got to let off their people to protect the local. And so all these guys were down there, you know, when we came around the block, you know, and looked and we seen all these people, you know, and we got closer, we started recognizing them as CWA members. I said, what's going on? You know, they said, well, we're here because of you guys. And if, you know, you guys with one hand hurt the local, you're not getting out of the block. So we looked over at each other and we said, well, if this is what it's going to come to, if the union members are going to batter us, then that's what you're going to have to do, because we're going upstairs and we're going to see the president of this local, and he had the operator's leadership there, and we want to get a straight answer as to why we're fired, you know, and the union's not backing us. So we went upstairs, we pushed through them. There was a few scuffles, you know, as a matter of fact, I had a scuffle with them. Then president, you know, of the local. He wasn't president at that time, but he was one of the pieces. And we went up there and we presented our demands to them, you know, and then we left. And about a day and a half later, the company sent a letter saying that we were reinstated to the job, and that, you know, we should come to work, and that, you know, that we would be put under final warning or something. So we all went back to work the next day, because the operators had also said to the company, we're not going in until they get their job back as well. So we went in, but the operators said, you guys go in first a couple of days, then we're going in a couple of days after, and which they did. You know, but I thought that was a tremendous historic moment for telephone workers in New York and in other areas as well. It was certainly a lift for me as a black person and a labor person, understanding the strength in numbers and mass demonstrations and breaking rules that you don't agree with, that they're wrong, you know, and you're getting your way. So it has been a permanent part of how I understand, you know, struggle, you know, not only do I understand it from the outside, but on the inside as well, in terms of the labor movement. So it was then that we went back in and we decided that with the leadership of the local being the way it was, that we had to do something with the local. So we put together an organization called Brothers and Sisters for Equality, which later turned out to be the Vanguard Society, or somebody else had that name. And we decided we were going to run for office. And we pulled together a campaign with other dissatisfied Italians and Irish guys that were all allies with us, and we put together a ticket, you know. But just prior to that point, where we felt like we were at the end of our rope, we had actually planned a siege of the telephone company. We were going to go up there and chain the doors and chain the president in at 140 West Street and make demands to the newspaper. That's how crazy it comes. And we said, that's crazy. We never would do it. But that's how desperate we were at, you know, to get results, and even at the cost of our own economic well-being, you know, whatever else might have. But that was the times we were in. That was the moment, you know, where we felt that we were fighting, we were winning, and you know, we were principled and strong at that. And through the course of that discussion, the elections were coming up. We said, no, we're running for election. And we can really begin to change something. We had never thought about it. At this time, I'm still the only highest ranking Black in there. So we announced that, you know, it's the first that we were running. And we had a few candidates, and then we got together with other groups, and we built an entire slate. And we ran. And as a matter of fact, I was the only one out of my slate that won. And they threw the election out because I won. And they forged another election. In that election, you know, I even won by a larger margin, you know, the second time around. And some of the other people I was running with still didn't win, but we thought it was an unusually huge vote that came out. And we suspected that it was hanky-panky. Long story short, with the Labor Department and the FBI, it was hanky-panky. And that was well into our term in 1971. And during that period of time, with that series of fights to get people in office, the FBI came and said, well, you clearly won, you take office. Even though I was denied when I came up, you know, for my right to term, they said, you're not letting me in office. I said, why? Well, no, I don't. He says, no way. Yeah, as far as we're concerned, you're AWOL. If the company wants to buy you, they can. You know, but I said, no, give me an excuse day off tonight. I kind of suspected something like this was going to happen. But, so I got in after a month while the FBI and the Labor Department was investigating this election, and they sat us down one day and they showed how the election was fixed, and they were over the ballots, and they told the people that had fixed the election, they said, let me tell you something, if you want to still get up all these ballots, you know, we'll do what you guys have done in jail. And we opened up the Senate level, and if you want to agree that this is what happened in all the time, you get a lot of the money, which they did. And we took office first Black African American, you know, NCAA at that point, you know, to gain office, you know, that size of that as well.
So you become the first African American officer in CWA local
1101,
and this is the largest local in the CAW at the moment.
CWA.
Or CWA. That's my UAW orientation, right? CAW is across the river. Sorry. And then you quickly, in that same year, in 1971, you quickly become the strike coordinator for what is still the CWA's longest strike, 7.5 months. Could you tell us a bit about the strike?
Well, the strike was unprecedented in many ways. For one thing, it was unauthorized. You know, there were a series of conventions in 1970 which set the stage for negotiations and just how the strike was going to be managed because it was a nationwide strike. And Joe Byrne, you know, who was the only president of CWA up until that time, you know, wanted to make sure with a national strike that he had some control on. So they set up a set of rules at a special convention. If any one district or region was out, that all other regions, if any region turned down the contract, this national contract, then all regions would stay out until, you know, we were all for one, one for all. So that was the basis of the 1971 negotiations that were going on.
What were the issues that you were concerned about at this time? Because if you're anticipating a strike, I'm assuming there were some set of issues.
One huge issue, maintenance of dues. Maintenance of dues is tremendously important for CWA because members would come in and they leave out when they got pissed off, and it would take the membership of CWA, which at that time was 125,000 members, up from 125,000 to almost 500,000 overnight, you know, because everybody had to pay dues into the union. So no matter what the other issues were, economic as they may have been in terms of pay, so this was number one, and we didn't get that. And so the rules were set down that this was going to be the strike. And then something happened. what happened was Nixon had called in big players all around the country, other institutions, and Joe Byrne was one of these people he called in. This is just prior to the final finality of all negotiations. We had authorized a strike until we got what we wanted. The company had made their final offer in or about the two-week area, after 2 weeks. And at that time, we didn't know there was going to be a Nixon wage price freeze or anything like that. So he knew that, but he wasn't sharing that with us. And then all of a sudden, you know, when we saw the demand, we said, nah, we're short of a lot of things, not only the salary and economic issues, not sufficient, but we still need to get maintenance and dues. And we said, hey, and we urged the our constituency to turn this down. And that was around the end of July. And Joe came in and says, hey, you know, you guys, you got to go back in. You know, we're going to go back in whether your constituency turned it down or not. We told Joe to take a fine shit somewhere and we were going to hang and fight. You know, and bingo, the wage price freeze comes out of nowhere. And then there's hesitancy over the rest of the national unions as to whether they should go with us or stay. And Joe orders everybody to work, including ourselves. And we tell him, no way, we're going to fight it. And so we were stuck out there with this wage price freeze happening. And Joe said he refused to, our strike was illegal. He was not going to support us. And we were stuck out there. He says, you're wildcatting. And he said, I'm not going to support it. And you guys have to go to hell. Well, Ricky Carnival was the president of the local at that time. He was a short Italian guy, you know, was very, very, you know, vocal, had a voice like a bass drum, you know, could really carry an inspiring note. Came down to yelling and screaming. And we were when you looked at the executive board, we were fighters, we were street fighters, we were scrappers, we were used to the wildcats and everything, and we were dying to take this company on and to bring them down. We had all kinds of ideas of them coming to their knees, you know, during this period of time. We had no idea that it was going to last 7.5 months. So we stayed out on strike. By this time, the headlines everywhere was the wage price freeze, and one of the only entities still on strike was the CWA. And they were out on strike in New York. And what was going to happen here? So Joe, at the same time, is sending signals out there, subtle signals that you guys get back in, you got no business out there, you're hurting the economic situation of your workers, you're hurting the union, the whole works. We stood our ground. And somewhere in the beginning of September, we started, even though we were scheduled for strike fund money, Joe said, this is unauthorized, you're not going to get it. So we started sending out appeals to certain labor constituencies that were out here, and we need your help. That embarrassed Joe to some extent. You know, but the bottom line was that we were out there, and everybody started knowing that these guys, you know, whole state, Jersey and New York are out there fighting the telephone company against the wage price freeze. Somehow we get the crown of fighting against the wage price freeze without strike. And they start sending in money. So it embarrassed Joe, and Joe had to not only recognize our strike, but he had to open up the strike fund for us and get in front of this thing on his white horse, you know, to lead it. So that struggle, it lasted you know, up until February 22nd of 1972. But during that period of time, you know, I had a strike committee that I put together, and in many cases the process was that nobody could get any kind of due monetary rewards from the union unless they served strike duty and they had been through the strike committee. So it was almost all black. Can you imagine? I'm the first black up there, and they had never seen this. All of a sudden they walk into a room and there's Angela Davis picture on the wall and you know, and all of these folks and everything, and they walk in, they look around, especially if they were white, and then they walk back out again and said, no, that couldn't be the place. Then they come back in again, you know, and after they were directed by the treasurer, you got to go downstairs and talk to the strike committee and make sure that you've done what you were supposed to do, you know. And after people found, you know, after a little while, when they found out who we were and the stuff that we were doing and participating with us, they loved it. They love the music, and we had as many white guys as the black guys down there hanging around, you know, talking stuff. But it was, we were arrested regularly during that whole process of time because we found that we couldn't stop dial tone in the city. Everybody picked up a phone, so who the hell knew we were on strike? So we had to do extraordinary things to gain attention. We block up the Midtown Tunnel, you know, we block up Midtown, you know, New York, you know, and Wall Street area. We had demonstrations. We'd get busloads of folks and ship them up into where the bosses lived and so forth and so on. So we had to get very creative about, you know, taking this thing to the city and to the company to get some pressure on the stockbrokers' meetings. We busted them up. We were always getting arrested. It was almost routine. All the inspectors knew who we were. You know, there were some very, very serious fights that we had. We had police horses. We had confrontations where there was damage and a lot of injuries, you know, with horses going down and things like that. Reminiscent of the old 30s, you know.
Yeah, I
mean, guys had marbles and the horses would be falling and those kind of things would start to happen. And then we had some serious confrontations where we had the judge refused to rule on strike breakers that the company was sending from out of town. And we had to go up and raid City Hall and then to pull us up here and call the judge's chamber to rule on out-of-town strikers at that time. And the judge said, I'm not going to do it, and threw the case to somebody else, you know. So it was very, very serious, and we got wives and kids and everybody involved in it. And it was a struggle that every day the strike was over.